Welcome to the Way We Parent podcast, a podcast where we challenge the old paradigms of parenting and work on raising the next generation of rule breakers, because there is no way to be a perfect parent, but a million ways to be a good one. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 11 of the Way We Parent podcast. My name is Samantha.
And this is Paula. And today we have another amazing interview for you with the amazing Tracy Castles.
She is a researcher and founder of Evolutionary Parenting.
She is so incredibly knowledgeable. And one of the things I love about Tracy is that she looks at all the research around sleep training. That's a special interest of her, but she looks at parenting as a whole, hence the name Evolutionary Parenting. And really is able to look at the nuance of it and contextualize it for people. And I think that's really, really critical because we often see people just kind of throw around studies and they're like, such and such study proves X, Y, Z. They completely miss all the nuance around it. And so I really, really appreciate Tracy's work. I'm a big fan of the Evolutionary Parenting podcast.
Yeah, I love even the terms evolutionary parenting and scientific motherhood. I love both those terms because it encompasses how parenting changes and evolves, how we as parents change and evolve, how we as a culture look at parents and children, and then how those things get like passed down. And then scientific motherhood, it's like motherhood is very, especially now that I've done my own learning around this, it is very much intuitive and it's very much learning and being aware. Mm-hmm. And you can't really rely on just one or just the other. Like, I think it's a mistake to rely only on science. And I think it's a mistake to rely only on our instincts, because some of our instincts, like my instinct is to yell when I get mad or frustrated, because that's the only thing that I know how to like do. So like if I only relied on my instincts and not research and like unlearning and relearning, that wouldn't be good either, but it's both. And so scientific motherhood, that term to me encompasses both those things.
Yeah. Well, scientific motherhood, the idea around it is more sort of a critique in a way of this phenomenon that we see when, parents are so reliant on information and on science. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we see that all the time and it's parents are saying, well, you know, research says sleep training is beneficial. Mm-hmm. But instead of saying, but my gut says it's not, it's wrong.
And also the research doesn't really say that. The headline that you read said that. But yeah, and that's what I teach people this in my prenatal classes. I always say, if you want to, you can find quote unquote research to back literally anything you want. So if you're going into it thinking, I want to sleep train my 4-month-old and I want to be told that that's okay and safe to do, you can find something that'll tell you that. Yeah. And you can also find something that'll tell you sleep training emotionally damages your child and affects them for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. I don't think either of those extremes are always 100% true.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, so it's like you can find research to support any freaking number of things if you want.
And I think it just, we've given up, like we don't use our own critical thinking. I think that's the biggest issue. And I'm not, you know, criticizing parents for this. I think this is just a product of our society. And I mean, you know, I could go on forever about how our society has created this for us. And and it's this idea that we have no power. We must listen to those who are smarter than us. You know, your pediatrician knows everything, because they, you know, and so, there's a lot of issues with this idea of scientific motherhood. So I appreciate Tracy Castles. Excuse me. I really appreciate her for that. I guess, you know, before we get into the episode, I have a question for you, Samantha. Is there a time in your parenting journey so far that you have, I guess, you know, either not listened to your intuition and wished that you had, or almost been swayed by, you know, the research?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, I've talked about this probably before, but I definitely got kind of immersed in like sleep training culture for a while when she was a baby. And just not even, I never successfully sleep trained her. And mm-hmm. we never gave it like 100% effort either. But certain things would really stress me out. So like eat, play, sleep is the perfect example, that the routine that we're supposed to follow of eat, play, sleep. Research shows it's best not to feed them to sleep. You feed them when they wake up and then they'll, you know, have their awake time and go to sleep. It never worked. It never, not a single time did it work. And so that is a time when it was like, it seemed like everything online said that that's the best thing to do. Books say that that's the best thing to do. Specialists say that's the best thing to do. And yet somehow it was like not happening for us. Instead of just being like, okay, that's all well and good. Maybe it works for some people, not for us. I just got really stressed about it for a while. So yeah, that's for sure a time. And you know, even with like night weaning, we were night weaned for a while and then she got sick and I started nursing her at night again. And I could have not done that and it would have gone against my intuition. It was like, no, I think she needs this. Yeah. Like she's sick and I just, is she going to go back to waking to nurse? Yes, she absolutely has. And you know, it's just, I don't know. I felt like it was the right thing to do in the moment and I'm glad I did it. What about you? Have you done that too with like research that you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, excuse me, I definitely fell into sleep training culture as well in the early days. I knew I did not want to sleep train. I went into parenthood knowing I'm like, that feels wrong. Any type of cried out, any type of fervor, like I remember seeing it on TV, like, you know, in shows. And I was like, why are people doing that? Like, I just, it never sat well with me. Yeah. But I still tried to do, you know, no, and I actually didn't nurse him to sleep for a very long time. It wasn't until he got older that he really wanted to nurse to sleep. But for the longest time, I didn't nurse him to sleep. I would put him in his crib, drowsy but awake. You know, I did all those things. I had this idea that if I just fed him enough that he would sleep through the night. And, you know, all of these things, right? All of these unrealistic expectations that society gives you. And and I think the worst part of it is this idea that your worth as a parent is inherently tied to how your child sleeps. And it's something that I think it's an unspoken thing. Like not, people don't say that to your face, like, oh, you're such a great parent. Your kids sleep so well, but it's a thing, you know, you talk
and
to
your
other moms
child's and, worth.
Right.
I and really like, don't like how people will talk about like, you're so lucky. Your son is so good. Like what a good son, what a good baby you have that he sleeps through the night. Like how awesome that he does that, da 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 da. And it's almost like the kid's worth. And I'm like, okay, yeah, if your kid does sleep through the night, that's cool. And that is amazing. Good for you. Yeah. But also like a kid who doesn't sleep through the night is still just as good of a kid. Like,
yeah. And I mean, I'll have family members be like, is he sleeping through the night? And I was like, and I'm like, no, I mean, now he is. And so I actually was talking to someone just yesterday and I was like, oh yeah, he just started sleeping through the night and you know, he's almost two. They're like, what? Kids like don't sleep through the night until they're almost two. And I even like automatically felt like shame. Like I felt ashamed and I was like thinking to myself, like, why does this still bring up these feelings? Even though I know perfectly damn well that it's normal. And I know perfectly well that I had never had an issue with his wakes. Like I don't have an issue with it, but society does. And so it's easy to fall into that trap of wanting to show off and say, oh, look, I have a kid that sleeps through the night and whatever. Right. And I mean, even yourself, I know you've said that your daughter has slept through the night and now she's waking, like kids go through phases. Like it's not like he's sleeping through the night now and that's going to happen forever.
Right. Yeah. And that's a really important thing to remember. Like we always talk about how sleep is not linear. They don't like sleep for 4 hour stretches and then five and then six and then seven and so on until they sleep through the night forever. Like that's not how it goes. Unfortunately, like,
that's how but I thought it was when I had it.
I did too. When my daughter was 8 weeks and she slept like really good for like an 8 week old baby, she slept really good. She would sleep like 5 or 6 hours at the start of every night.
Same.
Yeah. And I was like, this is great because by the time she's 12 weeks old, she'll be like sleeping through the night at this rate, you know, like she keeps increasing. Well, no, that's not how it happens.
Yeah.
And even research, like, I try to explain this to people I always struggle, like I talk about research with like breastfeeding and things like this. So for example, prolactin levels are higher at night. So we know that especially when your baby is younger and getting all of their nutrition from breastfeeding, that if we cut out night feedings without the baby leading that, if we cut out the night feeds, that can lower your milk supply and they may not get their needs met in the day from you because your prolactin is so high at night compared to during the day that if you don't right. feed during those hours, your body's going to suppress milk production from it. So like, yes, research does show that. And mm-hmm. there are also individuals that can cut night feeds and don't see any difference in their milk supply. Yep. So just because research shows something doesn't mean it happens 100% of the time. Cause I've like every time I talk about this, somebody will message me and say, oh my gosh, we stopped doing night feeds two weeks ago. Or like I cut out one or two night feeds or whatever, or pumps. And it seems fine. Everything seems fine. But how do I know like that something's wrong or is my milk supply going to go away now? I didn't know. And I'm like, no. If you've been doing it for weeks, then you're fine. Then okay, you're fine. Like just because research shows something doesn't mean it's the law. Yes.
And I think that's so important because I think that's where people have a really hard time is understanding that every baby's different. So it was actually funny the other day I put out like a question box on Instagram saying, you know, is this normal, right? Mm-hmm. And people were like, is it normal that my baby wakes up, you know, 2-3 times, whatever. I was expecting those questions and I'm like, yeah, of course it's normal, whatever. But there was a couple of people who were like, my like, you know, 8-week-old sleeps through the night. Like, should I be waking him? You know, so that's the other extreme. The people whose kids are naturally sleeping through the night with no sleep training. Yep. Now they're worried because they're hearing it's normal to wake up. And I'm like, yeah, it's okay too if your kid doesn't wake up. As long as it's not like you force them into it and as long as they're gaining weight and everything's well.
Yeah, I always say, are they developmentally? Yeah, are they developmentally on track? Are they gaining weight well? Then sounds good.
That's mm-hmm. and that's it. And that's really, you know, the issue that we have with that. So so with Tracy, we talked a bit about some common misconceptions and mm-hmm. it was such an amazing conversation. She's so brilliant.
She is highly so recommend.
She's been doing this for quite some time. So we have been super honored with some of our guests, all of our guests this season.
Yeah, really. All of our guests are like brilliant people.
Yeah, so I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I think without further ado, let's get into our words from our sponsor.
It's so nice that you're here. I am such a fan, as you probably know, because I've like tagged you a million times. I listened to like your podcast and I've taken your courses. And so thank you for everything that you do to explain really the science to people, because I think that's so important. Before I have so many questions for you, but before we get started, could you give us a little, you know, introduction to who you are and your background? And how long have you been doing evolutionary parenting for?
Oh God. Yeah. So I'm Tracy Castles. I do run Evolutionary Parenting and it's a resource I started in 2011. So we're coming up on 10 years, very shortly. Cause I think it was like May, 2011 was our kind of time there. So the 10-year anniversary starting up, I started that while I was still a graduate student and I had my daughter and just researching, kind of seeing what was mainstream out there versus what I was reading in the research, mm-hmm. I was like, there's a big gap between what's happening here. And this is rather frustrating because, you know, someone else is saying, oh no, the research all says this. I'm reading the actual research and it's not saying that at all. That's not what's happening here. So I ranted to my husband long enough, who eventually was like, you just need to write it down. And I think he got sick of being the only person to listen to it over and over again. So he set me up and it kind of started as just a source of my verbal vomit there of everything towards working with families one-on-one, creating courses, doing continuing education courses for professionals, conferences, and so on. So it's just kind of built organically through nothing I've done because I know nothing about marketing or the likes. And most recently started the podcast, thanks to my husband again, who pushed me to do it because he's the creative guy in the family. So he does video work and everything. And he has his own podcast and got me kind of into it, but that's been, he's forced me into this, and I'm thankful every time he does, because I love what he forces me into, but it really takes a lot of pushing. I'm a little hesitant on all of those to begin with, because they're out of my comfort zone. But
yeah. I think it's wild that you've been doing this since 2011, because the parenting coaching, like sleep coaching, even like breastfeeding support is really my main focus. And just the like parenting space, I feel like seems like to me a new thing that has evolved from like social media and such, but you know, it's not. I think it's just evolved in how it's done now, or like how mm-hmm. we find that information and so on. But what are your thoughts on that? How has this changed for you?
Well, so you have to remember, I didn't start with the parenting coaching. I was still doing my PhD. So that shifted. I didn't go into this saying, I want to do parenting coaching. That was, it actually came about, I was still doing my PhD. And I had a couple of families email me asking, can I just get your help on this? And I'll pay you for your time. And I was like, I don't, you know, coaching wasn't a thing. It really wasn't. I mean, I'm sure it did exist somewhere in the ethernet, like somewhere,
Okay.
But I hadn't heard of it as a thing. And I went to my friend who's a lawyer, and I'm like, can I do this? Like, legally? Can I, like, what? She's like, well, you're not pinning yourself as a psychologist. You're not, you're just coaching. And I guess she had, so it was in the ether there. So she knew, she's like, you're just pinning yourself as like a consultant or a coach. Yeah, you can do that. Just be clear that that's what you are. I'm like, cool. All right. So I did it for a few people and then opened up, and it grew from that. Just after working with a couple of families, it just started happening. So, I mean, I think social media, I've seen the ups and downs. So when I first started, Facebook was, you know, the thing, and it was, they actually, for a period there, the reach and the growth you could have in reaching families was huge. And it was really positive. It was excellent for a business perspective. It was excellent to just get this information out there to families, right? Which is so hard to do. And then they went public, throttled everything. And, you know, if you don't pay, you're not, you get no reach really anymore, especially not for organic content. You can get it if you're sharing, you know, the New York Times or other companies that do pay Facebook to get their content shared. So that's been a little disappointing in seeing that. And of course, other mediums have popped up, Instagram being most notable. And I admit I steered clear of Instagram for years, even though maybe that was not a good idea from a business perspective, but I've never made decisions on a business perspective. I don't like, I tend to be someone who's just, I don't get it. I don't enjoy it. I date myself here. I'm just too old for it. And so I'm learning it as we go, and it's been lovely. Like I've met new people and new clients from it, but I'm still not comfortable with it. So I don't know, you know, Instagram, I'm sure I've seen the evolution of Facebook go down in that regard. I imagine I'll see Instagram go down in that regard, especially because it's also owned by Facebook. And so I don't know what'll be next. I don't know how it will go. And I think it's just a matter of, you know, from the perspective of someone working in this field, it's a necessary evil. But I do see it as a necessary evil. It's because I think it does the echo chamber. People search for what they want to hear, as opposed to at the beginning, what I witnessed with Facebook was you were actually reaching people that didn't know this stuff. There was, you know, it wasn't just you search for what you're looking for. People are getting things out there that are contrary and new, and they get excited by it. And I would get emails regularly from people like, I just saw this. I'd never even heard of this or thought of this, but it popped up in a feed from a friend because of this. And that natural growth, I think, was really important for a more gentle parenting movement. And that's kind of divided from social media, because you are just going towards what registers with what you already think.
The algorithm has gotten too good. That's what I always think. It's like it used to show you, oh, you're interested in parenting stuff. Here's this type of parenting and this type of parenting and this type of parenting, all the parenting. Now it's you're interested in this very specific type of parenting. That's all you'll see. Which I think it's like, you know, the algorithm is built like that on Instagram and Facebook, and it's just gotten too good. And you could apply that to parenting or politics or whatever else you want to apply it to. But it, I have to tell myself that, like, I'm only seeing this little sliver of the internet. This is not what it looks like for everybody. This is not everyone's experience on it.
I was just going to say, part of what I face with that is I've always been one to write research in a much more attempted, nuanced way, because even some of the research that likes to be promoted for gentle parenting doesn't always support that. And I always view my job as going through and writing up, okay, what can we take from it? And when you're in an echo chamber and people have heard time and time again, oh no, this is really truly what happens with, say, Cry It Out. And you have to go, actually, no. And it's not that I'm for Cry It Out. Trust me, I've made my entire base on the fact that for a long time, I was one of the few people who was adamantly against it. But I'm not going to lie about what the research says. And the research doesn't say that. But this echo chamber almost means I'm getting, I can't please anyone. I've got everyone angry who says, you know, no, Cry It Out is safe and effective. You're like, well, actually, no, it doesn't say that. No, it's horrible and it damages attachment and everything else. Well, actually, no, it doesn't say that either. And it's so I just managed to piss everyone off is how it goes, because I think this echo chamber is leading to this division.
Yeah, I think it's the echo chamber, but I also think it's the it's so different. You know, you started with a blog, right? You can write a long blog post and really kind of get to the nuance of things. In 2,200 characters, it's practically impossible to do that. And then on top of that, you want to have something catchy because you're trying to get people to share your content. And so, yeah. And I mean, I constantly get people who will argue against like a post, and I'm like, I get what you're saying, but I cannot possibly add all the nuance to this topic in one post. So like, you cannot, you know, just assume that, you know, why didn't you mention this? And why didn't you, it's like, well, I would love to, but it's not a blog post. Like, so I think that's a big challenge, but I love that you talked, that you mentioned Cry It Out, because that was what I wanted to ask you about. Because of course I care about sleep training as well. And I guess, because I think people ask this all the time, and I know they ask this of me, why sleep training? Why do we care so much? Like, you know, why not just, oh, some people like to cry it out, whatever. Like, why can't we just let them be?
I think there's, this is a hugely layered question. And one that I think, so why cry it out at all? I mean, I would first start with, why the hell do we even have it? What is, you know, why is it so popular? And I think the big thing is looking at, frankly, a capitalist patriarchal culture. And it is, you know, it's funny. I had Abby Thuring, the badass breastfeeder, on a podcast that just came out last week. And, you know, as she puts it, just with breastfeeding, why, you know, are there struggles? Why do we care? Why do we have this division? Capitalism. Let's just always just throw capitalism in there as probably one of the most detrimental things to our society, especially the version that exists here, because this is not free market capitalism. We could get into that as economist, but no, it's not free market capitalism. It is very different. But what it's done
oppression.
Is,
it's
yeah,
that's what it
has
it is.
Created this view of human utility that is based on an economic market. And so what we have happening with a lot of families is your value, there is no value in supporting families and children. We do not view children as the center of our culture to raised with values that are akin to ours and have them grow into whole people and respect them as people. They are people to grow into those that will serve our economic needs. And that has a very different trajectory. And, you know, we could say it's new to us, but it's not. The way our cultures have viewed children and their utility in terms of how they view people has led to a lot of periods in history where we've had detrimental parenting practices. You want to go look at the Spartans, and they, as warriors, would take children away from their mothers very young and raise them in a very harsh manner, to say the least, with the view that if they survived, they would be these tough, you know, really almost
warriors.
Negative people, but for their purposes of war was very positive. And so we've known for a long time that when we separate mothers and babies, when we separate, well, parents and babies, we do get these outcomes that can be conducive to what a society values. So we have to look at what does our society value. Autonomous workers who are kind of quote unquote independent, but not really, because if you're truly independent, you wouldn't actually be falling prey to what they want you to do. So we already have a societal push for this. And then we push parents to come back and be like, no, 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 no. You need to get back in the workforce. You need to have your life. Your value is not in raising a child. Your value is to us in making more money. And if we make society such that you can't even survive without making enough money, well, that makes it really easy to create these practices that separate parents. And of course, Jenny Roger and I wrote a paper that was published last year on the rise of cried out as authoritative knowledge. And so there's a whole host of other things that go into it, starting in the late 19th century with respect to beliefs about health that were erroneous. And, you know, that led to a lot of other, like the separation of bed sharing, because that was seen to be detrimental from a health perspective of the babies, and erroneous views about what makes a good person. So there's a lot of layers. So it's not just one thing, but what's perpetuated it in our culture, I believe, is this capitalistic push for everyone to be focused on the economy. And with that, you cannot have half the workforce home, whether it's mothers or fathers home. And then of course, because we've moved away from a intergenerational household, we also have that problem, because you look at cultures where that still exists. It's not like women don't work. They work very readily for their society. It's often a more nuanced work. It's more flexible. They're back and forth, but you have family members caring for children, and that allocare is actually qualitatively different from a care perspective than what we would see today. So to get there, we first have to look, why do we have that? So then why should we care? Why can't we just let everyone go to it? Well, first, I would say that our society is so damaged that from that perspective, we have to take a look at it and see what we can do to shift that. From the second perspective is we have to start looking at these, the practice of cry it out violates what we would call species expectant behaviors. And so from a biological perspective, we have to say, okay, what is happening when babies are born with a set of behaviors they expect? They expect close contact, for example, right? The types of mammals we are, we're not like cats where, you know, a mother cat can leave her kittens for 2 hours while she goes roaming. They've eaten enough. They don't wander. They're safe. We don't do that. That is not the type of mammal we are. And so it's very difficult for us to look at babies and say, well, when we do that, when we separate from them, what is the long-term sequelae of this? And, you know, to be honest, we don't know what it is because we haven't really looked at it. We can certainly take pieces of the puzzle and say, you know, most recently I wrote up an article from Niels Bergman looking at separation from a maternal caregiver in neonates and the heightened stress response from that that they show. So, but how long does that continue for? What does it mean in terms of neurological development? So there's lots of pieces that suggest the potential for damage. And certainly I don't think anyone looks at the mental health of our culture and says, we're doing awesome. So I think we can say there's probably something, but does it all stem back just to early parenting practices? No, it's going to be part of a global view of a cultural, not a global, a cultural view of what's happening in practice. So I think for me, it matters because we are violating these species expectant behaviors without knowing why. But I think we're also taking choice away from parents, because I've never met a parent who did cry it out. And this is why it's like, it's not a judgment of parents who do it. It's a society and professionals, quote unquote, experts who push it. And, but I've never met a parent who said, oh, I did it. That was the greatest thing we ever did. It rocked. It was amazing.
It felt we good on my instincts the whole time.
Right?
Like all I hear from loved people, it. Is like, it was so, it was the hardest thing ever. Like, oh, I felt this pull to go in there and I had to fight it. And I'm like, do you hear?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Exactly.
Well, I mean, I do hear people say, like, it was the best thing we ever did for our family. But then...
Well, at but the they're talking end of about it, the after effects, right?
Yeah. It's the, they're not talking about
the
moment.
And that's the judgment. And it's really hard to get away from that because sometimes we have to go... And that's what's so hard about the data is that people who say that don't even want to hear the data on how effective Cried Out actually is because it's not in terms of changing sleep. But as a parent, any choice we make... that we have to go back and say, oh crap, maybe that wasn't actually in the best interest of my child and I chose to do it. That can feel so heavy and so hard that we have to step back and be like, nope, I'm not going to think about it. No, it had to have a benefit. And that's why the narrative around Crying It Out keeps changing, because when people say, no, it's really good for them. Well, it started by saying babies need to sleep more. And sleep is so important. We know the importance of consolidated sleep. They need to sleep. And look, when we sleep train, they are sleeping longer. So it must be benefiting their cognitive growth, their overall well-being, their health, et cetera.
Right.
And then suddenly we get only a handful of studies that actually started including objective measures of sleep. So things like actigraphy. And what they find is that, oh, actually their sleep isn't changing at all afterwards. So the number of wakings, when they look at it before and after, the kids aren't sleeping anymore. They're not waking any less. Right. There's absolutely no difference. And so we go, oh, well, it's not actually the sleep. We know the sleep isn't a problem, but they're learning to self-soothe. And that's a really important skill to learn how to self-soothe. So we really want to build our kids to have that. And then we look at the emotion, the literature on emotion regulation, and we go, well, actually, we don't know that's happening either, because they're not calling
no
out,
such thing
but
as self-soothing.
We have time and again, well, A, they're not exactly, from an active perspective, age, they're not self-soothing, but also we now have a ton of evidence of kids who look like they're emotionally regulating. And when we, again, dig deeper, this behavior and physiology are telling two different stories. So can we take it clear that a child is actually self-soothing from distress? No. And so again, we just keep having, and then the narrative will shift again, because I do think eventually there will be studies looking at this.
I always come back to a theory, you know, just a feeling I have about our culture, the way that we see babies and children is they are a problem to solve. Like, I have this problem. They don't sleep all night. I want to sleep all night. It's a problem. How can I solve it? They don't feed like on the pattern that I need them to for my life to work the way I want it to. So that's a problem and I'll solve it. And like, they're throwing tantrums and I want to be able to do this. And so like, that's a problem and I'll solve it. We have just created this idea that the babies and children are a problem and we can fix it. We have these ways of fixing the problems. But I have never linked these two, and my mind is kind of blown. Like, now that I've linked it, it's the capitalist society making us think that our babies are a problem. It's actually not a problem that they wake and would call out for a caregiver in terms of like development and emotions. And like, that's not actually a problem. We have made it a problem because we need our parents to be working their asses off for our capitalist society. And they can't do that if they're caring for a child, right? Like,
I actually have a post that's exactly that. And I got so much like, mostly like people saying good things, but then I had obviously the random people who show up. I said, sleep training culture is a byproduct of a colonized patriarchal capitalistic society. And of course I had the people who are like, oh, aren't you being a little extra? And I'm like, no, like, because people don't want to take a good look. They don't want to take that critical look at our society, because then they'll go, well, what does that mean? Like, if my entire worldview is being challenged all of a sudden, if you're telling me that I am a product of a white supremacist patriarchal society, then what does that mean about me? You know? And so people don't want to be critical.
And that's all we've ever known, is a white patriarchal capitalist society. I mean, look at it, you know, in North America, that is the only thing that we know. And there isn't a generation here that knows any different. And so I think it is something that is of challenge to us, because we're like, well, I do need to sleep. I do need to work. Like, I financially have to work for this company and I have to make X amount of money and I have to do this. And, you know, it doesn't seem like there's another way. And I think that we're at a pivotal point in our culture where we're going to forge another way. Like, I think we're coming to the point of like, we'll forge another path.
Well, and I think there's two thoughts on this here. The first one is that one of the groups of research that I really love going on, Helen Ball has done some of it already, is starting to look at immigrants who don't come from a white supremacist capitalist culture, and how are their interpretations of our parenting advice, our sleep advice, everything playing out. And it is fascinating because you do see both some just pure resistance, depending on how much they buy into their culture. They're like, oh, well, they're just not talking about us because that's just ridiculous. Because right. we all sleep with our babies. That's what we do. And we're not changing yeah. that. So we're just not even going to listen. Two, a perspective of, oh dear, there's something really wrong with us. And this is almost what you see in a lot of immigrant cultures. They either assimilate so completely, they actually take it almost stronger than people who are born, or they just shun it altogether in certain ways of like, well, that's just not what we do. And, you know, that's, it's interesting to see that we see those two perspectives coming out when looking at people that don't come from our culture. I love the anthropological research that tries to bring some of our ideas to other cultures where they just go, what is wrong with you people? Why would you, like, what do you mean you leave your baby to cry? Why? That's like, there are anthropological reports of other people and cultures suggesting, yes, that's child abuse. For them, plain and simple, that is child abuse. And we just don't see it because of how that goes. But the second kind of thought here is on the way in which this also manifests when people do step away from it. So there are people who are privileged enough to be stay-at-home parents and everything. And, you know, I think sometimes they can think, nope, we're bucking it, we can do this. But actually the capitalist society still has a hand in this. And it's a conference presentation I gave a few years ago on this, but it's the idea that our visions of motherhood in particular, because it's often stay-at-home mothers, it's not, is that you have to then be the perfect mother. If you are shunning this capitalist society, you better be doing everything else yourself. Don't you ever try to ask for help, get help cleaning the house, get help to, we have a very strict moralistic view that if you are stepping outside, for these women that are staying at home, you know, nothing they can do is positive. They are, you know, always facing this struggle because they are being judged by a standard that is just inhumane and being told constantly they still don't know what they're doing. So they're still having to look at experts to come down and tell them how to be this quote unquote perfect parent.
I think it's, I love that you mentioned that because I think it's so interesting being, you know, I know you're from Ontario as well. And so for those of us who live here in Canada, but we are so surrounded by American culture, right? And so we know Americans, you know, there's like, it's just despicable, the maternity leave or lack thereof in the States. And so I've, you know, I've always thought that it's like, it makes sense to me why Cry It Out is so popular in the States, because of course, if you have to go back to work at 2 weeks, what the hell are you supposed to do? Right? Like, I get that. But then you look at, Canadians, and most moms are taking a year of maternity leave or 18 months. And then you're going, well, why are you still doing Cry It Out? Like, like, you're home with your baby, right? And so it doesn't, it kind of doesn't add up, but it's because we're so influenced by that culture. And again, it's like you said, I think, I mean, there's so many layers to it, but it's that idea of perfection, that competition. That like we want our kids to be perfect, and it's almost, and you get that sense, and I definitely
better.
I get that sense. Like, I remember when back we were allowed to leave our house, and we would go to like early ons and whatnot, and there's that like, how much is your baby waking up, and oh, my baby slept through the night, and it's like this competition among parents, and so and I think what I wanted to add to that too is that what I see as a big problem, and I don't know why it is that American culture is so just like influential in the world, but I see it because like I'm South American, and most South American countries have always been like same thing, like bed sharing, you know, no credit, none of that. But it's getting there. Like American culture, it's seeping its way through, and sleep training is becoming popular. I've heard this from people in Europe that, you know, and I think part of it is social media, part of it is all of that. And so it's just this really frustrating thing where these, all of these cultures and countries that were previously doing their thing are now being influenced by this culture that's built on capitalism and all this nonsense. So it's, I don't know. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. That was like a long thought.
No, it's interesting. And I don't think we can just blame the US. I mean, let's be honest. If we go back, the British really had a hand in this back a long time ago. The Victorian era and the separation, children should be seen, not heard. You know, there was a lot of that happening early that made it to the US, and the US may have perpetuated it more so. But that kind of practices have been in place in the UK for a very long time. So it's been very dominant there as well, even though, again, they've had maternity leaves, they've had other things in place. But that idea of children has existed for quite a while. The movement into other cultures is interesting because, yeah, I've seen it too, but I've also seen resistance to it. And this is, I'm not even sure if it's capitalistic so much as it is just more an idealization of different cultures that's been perpetuated within the US. Is the US still manages to make it seem like we have the greatest culture on earth because they're not facing, I mean, God, they face so many troubles. I still don't even know how that persists today, but that's been a big push for people along there, is that we want to be like them, not even because of capitalism, just because of a belief about a superior culture. And I mean, let's face it, it's probably really colonialization that's taking place there around the world on a global scale without having to actually invade on a one-on-one level. It's just we go into it there because that colonialization can happen now almost without having to set foot. As a country, we can set foot via policies, via the products we provide, the companies we allow to go in, and, oh, this is supposedly a better way. Because it's happening in these white, wealthy countries.
I would love to bring it back a little to something that you were talking about earlier, the value that we place on what we do as people, and how I really feel like we've taken the value out of parenting, like the kind of gentle, responsive parenting that we're talking about. Like, we really have devalued that so much. And I was listening to another podcast, and there's some stuff that I didn't like fully agree with on there. And I'm going to speak generally here about mothers, people who I would identify as a mothering role, because that's the majority of our listenership. And I want to just maybe bring up a hot button thing about feminism, because okay, so to be a feminist, you know, we're taught like you can work and have a job and make money and you're independent and you don't need a man to take care of you because you'll make your own money. And like, I am all for all of that. But what the underside of that is like, and also you can do anything, but like not just be a parent, because that, you know, you're so much more than being just a parent. Like just, why would you just want to be a mom when you could be working and actually having value? And like, you know, you're more than that.
And contribute to society, because you don't contribute as a parent. Exactly.
And that's like, that's not useful. Just want to bring that up because I struggle with this. Like, I'm not going to lie. I have always been, prior to being a parent myself, I said like, I will return to work. There is not a chance in hell I will be a stay-at-home mom or any form of it. And like, you know, I just really felt like I've always identified as a feminist. And now I have a totally different view. I still identify as a feminist. I've just redefined what that means. It means that I'm of value as a person because I'm a person, and I'm of value as a mom if I'm wanting to put more time into parenting or building a business or whatever. I can do anything, and that includes parenting my child the way I think is the right way. I just wonder your thoughts on that whole...
It's funny you say it. That is actually exactly what my conference talk was about a few years ago. This playground of, so it's, it goes back to what you're describing as I identified as a feminist and then suddenly I don't get to be because I'm a stay-at-home mom, is something actually my mom spoke about when she, you know, as a feminist in the 60s and then 70s and then had me, and she stayed home. And suddenly all her feminist friends were, you're not a feminist anymore. You're buying into this. That can't be a feminist route. So this is an ongoing debate that's happened for ages. And my take on it, and this is what I spoke about, and actually I have the piece up on EP for people to read. I just, what my talk was, I kind of transcribed. So it's a longer one. But was all about basically that our view of feminism, whether you want to call it a neoliberal feminism or patriarchal feminism, the problem is it's still rooted in this neoliberal patriarchal structures. Yep. So we still got everyone on the same playground. So the idea is we have to do the same things men do because that's still set as the default. So the idea of equality, first off, it's equality over equity, which is a very different debate that needs to happen. But our idea of equality is rooted in, okay, men have the power structure as it is. And so we want a piece of that power structure. But that leaves the power structure in place. And what is the power structure? It is capitalism. It is our value for how much we contribute to a society and our political power. Those are the areas that we have. And I'm not negating the need for more political power for women. But if it's only gained to perpetuate a system that is still racist, misogynist, capitalist, then we're not really doing a lot of good by joining that as it is. And so when we talk about feminism, there has been a huge push for this neoliberal feminism that really just views women's rights as being about attaining what men have. And my argument is that we actually need a whole new fucking playground. Is just tear it down, and we need a new one that values everything, that has this value of what we would normally call the feminine, which can be practiced by anyone, but that we see it still. And one of the things that really stands out with this is that when we talk about feminism and our value of the feminine, it's not there. Because again, when you have men that are attempting to take on more feminine roles, stay-at-home dads, everything, they still face immense backlash for this. They're viewed as weak or pathetic or, oh my God, you're not supporting your family. What's wrong with you? And this is not in all cultures. We see, you know, a lot of Scandinavian cultures embracing this, but then you see a Western backlash to those men. There's a view that they are less than or worthless. And that's because we still don't value the feminine. And it's why I see something like sleep training as actually an epitome of that, because what sleep training does, and it's been argued to be feminist because it allows women to get back to work and women take on the burden of nighttime care in most families.
Yes, but exactly.
If we switch the paradigm and say, actually we value the work that is predominantly feminine, the nurturing, the caring, the everything, all these jobs that pay shit would suddenly actually have value. You know, a nurse suddenly isn't struggling to survive while dealing with COVID patients and no care for their kid. You know, care workers in homes would be paid appropriately.
I was going to say, I mean, my background is as an early childhood educator, and it is such an undervalued job, and hence why most people don't stay in the field. And there you go, that like jobs like that. And actually Samantha's background is as a nurse. So, preaching to the choir.
This shift. And then
in
terms of that, suddenly nighttime care becomes valued. Suddenly the idea that you're nurturing becomes a valued component of site, and people support you in that. The way we support businesses, not the people that work for them, but certainly we have tons of structures in place. If you're failing, you can get loans, you can go into bankruptcy without having to pay your creditors. There's all sorts of safety nets in place for business, but we don't have those same safety nets for people, and particularly not people who are doing a more feminine type of work. So I think to me, that's the issue with feminism, is that it's the type of feminism we've now got to, which is still based on this neoliberal framework.
I still felt like I don't have a choice. That's what I kept thinking, is like, I said I was going to go back to work. That's what I always thought. I'm a freaking feminist. So like, I don't have a choice now. I need to go back to work and put my child in daycare. Like, this is like what my option is. And realizing like, that's not what I want to do. It's not the life I want to have right now. And look, I'm building a business. My daughter's in a part-time, 2 days a week in home daycare with like 4 other kids. So like kind of, I call it hybrid. So like, I'm not, you know, 100% of anything right now, but like, it's my, I now feel like I'm building a life that is my choice. Whereas before, yes, you know, and I said this to my husband, taking care of the house and doing our laundry and cleaning and cooking and maintaining this household and caring for our child and raising a toddler is paid work if somebody else were doing it.
Yeah.
But I'm absolutely doing it. So it's zero value and zero money. And I'm not saying I should, how would you pay in your own household? But you get what I'm saying. Like, mm-hmm, so it is work. We'll all agree it's work if somebody else is doing it. But yes, when you mm-hmm do it yourself, it's suddenly you're not working. So you don't have a job. And I'm like, I have a freaking job. What do you mean? Like,
yeah.
How is it not empowering to raise your own child? How is that not an empowering right thing to be nurturing and foster the emotional intelligence and secure attachment of a child? Like, now that I'm a parent, that nothing is more empowering to me than doing that. Like, it gives me chills a little bit because, you know, that's not something I had. And so to empower myself to be that for my child is like the best thing I could ever do. Whereas before, what I saw as being a feminist is like, I need to be Carrie from Sex and the City. That's that. Like, I gotta like make money and be a badass boss mom and, you know, kid in daycare.
And then your kids are basically an accessory.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'll have a kid because I'm, you know, it sounds like something I want to do, but really my goal, like, it's not really the thing that's empowering me. The thing that's empowering me is I get to do what I want and work. And, you know, yeah, I just see it so completely different. And I just wonder how many moms are out there, parents are out there in this situation, feeling that struggle internally of like, mm-hmm, I thought I wanted this thing, but then I feel differently now that I'm a parent, but I'm already kind of on that path.
Well, yeah, and I would say there's even another layer to that, which is, again, this idea that we would be the sole people to raise our children and be in charge is kind of a white feminist argument too, because most other cultures don't have this nuclear family. You have intergenerational households, mm-hmm, you have yeah external community support. And so we may be willing to offer up, okay, you mom, say you even get longer maternity leave. We only extend it to often the mother, not even the father mm-hmm sometimes. I mean, in Canada, we now have a bit more of a balanced view, and some other countries have it too, but it's to biological parents. We don't right offer leave to grandparents who may be able to stay home and take care of a child that is their oh grandchild.
Well, I haven't even thought about that. That would be amazing.
And I want, okay, so you had a post about kids leaving, how we don't really have this, you know, and how like maybe sometimes we feel like our generation as millennials, our home isn't like the safe place that we want to stay close to. Like, we may have a fine relationship with our parents now, but we're leaving. Like, we want to get out. We want to be mm-hmm away. And you were talking about that, and that made me think about exactly what you're saying. Because like, my husband and I, we've moved out of the state that we grew up in, and we have not been back since. So the closest family member to us is like a 12-hour drive away. So we've completely raised our child so far, like with, you know, 4-day visits every month or so from family. Like, that's all the family support that we've had. And it's a choice that we made. We didn't have to choose that, but we did. And I still would choose it every day going forward. And it's just so interesting to me to think like, oh, nurturing a secure attachment and being a safe place for a child actually is fostering this for the next generation to possibly like want to have more of this mm-hmm intergenerational like care system of a family. Whereas like, I didn't want that. And, you know, I mean, in an ideal world, I want it, but I didn't in the reality,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a different, and that is one of those things. And we don't foster the type of family structures that are different than this mm-hmm nuclear family, which is a predominantly heterosexual white family structure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when our policies still only speak to that, and our feminism still only speaks to this idea of you get to nurture your child, just you.
Yeah.
We're still not inclusive of the variety of needs that families have. You may have a mom that wants to go off and work, but she right also wants to have her kid raised by grandparents and have the ability to set that up without having this nest egg of wealth hidden away that most people don't have, yeah, right? Yeah. That is, And that's what I feel we should be fighting for.
Yeah. There's just so much to go into when it comes to feminism. Actually, it just reminded what you said. It reminded me of an old boss of mine who, I don't know how this came up, but it came up that my husband and I had like a joint bank account, and she was like, "You better have your own money stashed away. You better have your own." And I was like, "But we're a couple. Like, we do things together." And actually, we've always kind of had that. It's funny what you said about like having an allowance for your husband. We actually did that for a while, where, you know, like one of us, it was usually me, would take all the money, put it together, and pay the bills and whatever. And then this is what we get to spend, you know? And so it was never like my money, his money. And so this idea that I have to have like this money put away in case something happens, it's just, it's not a partnership in my mind. But, you know, people have different ideas, and that's totally fine. But it just made me think about like, she's probably coming from that white feminist mentality. She's an older generation for me. So I want to get back a little bit towards sleep training, because I know you already gave us so many good nuggets, and I encourage anybody who's listening to please go listen to Tracy's podcast, because it's so educational. And one thing I love that you do is you talk to people who disagree with you, which, as you said
sometimes earlier,
we have an echo chamber. Not everybody, but you know, I love that. I really appreciate that. So I think I have two questions, but the first one I want to say is, we see a lot of big names in the parenting world say sleep training is harmless, it's fine, right? And you kind of touched upon it a little bit, but I want to, you know, and these are not like, obviously there's a lot, in my mind, there's a lot of sleep trainers that make shit up, right? Yeah. Let's be real. But there are like smart, well-educated parenting people, you know, I can think of like Tina Payne Bryson, people, even like Emily Oster, who are putting out stuff saying sleep training is fine, whatever. Why do they say that? Why do they say it's safe?
So I think there's a couple ways to go here. So there were a couple studies that if you just read them on the surface and read the interpretations of the people who did them, are saying, look, we have evidence it's safe. So the first question we have to ask though is, what is our definition of safe? Is it babies aren't dying? Well, then okay. Yeah, it's probably safe. We haven't really seen that coming about, but does it do no harm? And this is, I think, a bigger question that's difficult to look at. So most studies haven't looked at that. So we have to be very clear. There is really a dearth of studies that have examined any kind of long-term outcome. So what we're looking at are really two studies that are, there's a few earlier ones that tried to look at it and they're equally bad. There's a lot of case studies or studies that may have only included six people, but there's tons of flaws within the studies themselves. And I think this is where the problem comes. You get educated people whose field doesn't necessarily give them the statistical knowledge to understand the methodological differences. So I'll take, you know, Emily Oster, for example. She's an economist and excellent with statistics, totally get stats. I always go back to my stats professor. So I did my PhD was in developmental psychology, but I also obtained a minor in psychometrics, which is a kind of combination of statistics and methodology. And he was very clear that economists have all the stats tools, but they don't understand social science variables because most of their work is done on very, what we would call hard variables. Money is money is money. The value of a dollar is the value of a dollar. Medical professionals have outcomes that are very hard. So they look at, did you live? Did you die? Did you get better? Did you not? Did you have a side effect or not? It's not loosey-goosey. So when we look at social science research, which is the essence of research in things like sleep training, because it has to be, there's a lot of nuance that gets ignored by people that haven't trained in that field. So for example, you have in one of the studies that is commonly cited is Anna Price and colleagues, and they did, you know, this supposed 6-year follow-up of mm-hmm. kids and found there was no difference between the two groups who they had randomly assigned to either receive an intervention on sleep training or not. And there's a billion statistical flaws with this one. First off, the measures that they use, so if we talk about just the measures that can be a problem, they are all parent report. So what we're mm-hmm. seeing is a parent's perception of their child and what they did. And as we know, our parental perceptions are not always accurate. Right. We can be pretty wrong. And as our kids get older, how many parents, you know, how many people do you know today go back and say, my parents totally knew me. They got what I was thinking. They knew everything. No, there's a reason, as we just said, many of us fled home because we had to get away. There was a sense of not understanding. So that's one of the methodological problems there. You then have, in that particular study, what I think is even more glaring is when they, because you can't randomly assign people to have to do an intervention like this. You can't say you must use Cry It Out. They couldn't control for who actually did it. So what they found was in their intervention group, approximately 40% of people declined to do the controlled crying. So when you go back to the original study, 40% said, nope, we're not doing it. And in the control group, we have no idea how many people did it on their own because it just wasn't discussed and they didn't ask about it. And in most of our naturalistic survey studies, we find that approximately 50%, ranging kind of 40 to 60, do try it. And that is, so now we have, when you look at just the groups themselves that you're comparing, because analyzed the groups as a whole and they used, again, a medical statistical technique called intent to treat, which is really important in medicine. It's hugely important to see, do we even have an effect of an intervention? But it doesn't tell us if you have an effect of the intervention because you're not looking at the people that received it. So at that point, or that took it up. So they used intent to treat analyses and found, again, no differences 6 years later. Well, if I'm looking at one group where, you know, approximately half the people tried sleep training and half didn't, and another group where, to the best of my knowledge, half the people tried sleep training and half didn't, and now I'm comparing them on outcomes that are, again, maternal report, we're not getting much out of it. So a lot of things like that are coming into play. So there's, and then the other study is Gratisar and colleagues. And that one tried to claim, again, there was no differences in attachment. So, and this is, we'll get to that second issue in a minute. He didn't have the power to detect a massive effect of attachment. And what power is when we're doing statistics, we have to know how many people we need in each group to detect a certain effect size. So if there is a real difference, will we be able to find it? Because statistical techniques are dependent upon the number of people you have in each group.
Right.
And he did not have that, like, just to put it in an example, the number of people they had in each of those groups, they did not have the power to detect one of the strongest effects we see, which is language development. So when you look at language studies, you need approximately 18 kids in each group to be able to, and language development is one of the biggest effects we have. All kids exposed to language seem to develop language, right? So we expect to see massive effects. He wouldn't have found massive effects. If he had done a study on language with the group he had, it would have come out, oh, look, kids don't learn language because we see no difference. Whereas, of course, we know that's not true. And yet that lack of significance, which should never be used, this is one of those basis things in psychology. If you retain the null hypothesis, which is you retain your that these two groups are equal, you can't say much at all. Unless you have such high power that you're like, okay, we feel confident we can say at least there's no difference in, and then it has to be very specific in this one particular outcome with respect to this. So, and then when you look at the raw numbers in that study, actually there was a relatively significant difference with respect to attachment. With the controlled crying group having the lowest levels at only 50%, the other groups coming in at about, I think it was 59 and 64. And more importantly, the disorganized attachment was much higher in that group. Again, would that pan out in a larger study? Maybe not. Maybe that's just the random fluctuations that come with small groups and we don't care about it. So there's these people, I think, that just by the very nature of the work they do is looking at variables a little differently, not necessarily understanding the variables, and certainly not understanding the long-term implications of both stress reactivity and attachment. because looking at attachment at one time period, and this is one of the podcast interviews I did with Dr. Levita D'Souza, who is an attachment researcher, right. and looks at attachment across as a clinical or counseling psychologist as well across the lifespan. Attachment isn't just something that happens at one time span. And when we look at age one, that attachment can manifest very differently than at age three or age five, when there are perhaps, as she puts it, more demands on the attachment system. And so we certainly haven't looked long-term at this. We haven't looked at it from the perspective of children. And I would say the other part we haven't looked at is in terms of Dr. Joan Grusick, who was at the University of Toronto, talks about domain theory. And I think it's really important to consider, because we tend to view, we have to look at this one thing, say, cry it out. Does it have this massive global effect on our children, which is part of what we're looking for? Well, maybe it doesn't, because it is one component. But maybe it has an effect on their stress reactivity to other stressors later on, to how they respond at night, nighttime fears. So looking at one effect, what are the domains we would expect to see outcome differences? Not, oh, their academics are going to suffer. That would make no sense. So we have to be clear about what it is.
But again, we live in a society that values productivity. And so therefore we value academics. So as long as they do well in school, obviously they turned out okay.
And we talked about it multiple times on this podcast, but there's a huge push now culturally for parents to like look at the research. Everything's like, look at the research, you know, see what the research said. And that's great and all, but you have to take into consideration that the general public doesn't know how to read and understand research in the way that you're describing. And so, yeah, look at the research, but have somebody who knows what they're talking about explain to you what this actually means. Because there's so many times I've heard people, and you know, as a nurse, like I learned about research studies and, you know, not as much as you, but I know the basics. And I've looked at so many studies that people have shared on social media. And I'm like, well, that's a huge flaw. That's a huge flaw. Like correlation does not equal causation. You have to look at like, there's so many things. And when you're looking at social aspects in a study, exactly what you were just saying, like attachment, things that don't have a, you know, okay, with this surgical method, did they get an infection? Yes or no? That is a clear cut, you know, we can study that and there's going to be concrete evidence either way. But there just isn't concrete things to study. And then it, like you said again, it evolves. And I wonder, so, you know, maybe you do cry it out or whatever kind of thing early on. Does that affect the attachment then? But then the way you parent as a toddler, when they become a toddler, like, does that change again? And then, well, did what you did as a parent change how you then parent your toddler? Like, there's so many things to look at when it comes to this.
It is. And, you know, I would say one of the other struggles in our, what I would say, research illiterate society is that everyone knows just enough to be dangerous. They have, you know, the little, they can kind of read the abstract, or even I'll say, yes, correlation does not equal causation, but there are times when we can look at a correlation and depending on the setup of the study and whatnot, we might be able to infer causation. And yet, heaven forbid, you suggest that and people, no, it doesn't equal causation. You're like, oh my God. But in social science, we often can't run studies that explicitly determine causation.
No, that's so true. This is exactly what I'm talking about. I only know medical research because I'm a nurse. Like the type of studies so in the medical world, correlation does not equal causation because, you know, so for example, the surgery and the infection, there's a certain percentage of infection rate. Like that's just like going to happen. Yeah. We're not going to be able to like have zero infection rate. So just because somebody got an infection doesn't mean that the cause was this change. And, you know, you have to prove that by like repeated. Yeah. But then you're talking about like in social science world, like how would you have a causation without it being from a correlation? There's not really a way
to
do it.
The way we have to do it. Yeah. The way that we start to infer causation. And again, it's very clear we're inferring it. We're not assuming it is again, things like longitudinal studies so that we are at least at this baseline, seeing it cross this way, we're controlling for as many of the variables that are relevant, but again, other variables pop up that might be relevant. And it's why, you know, one of the things I love about what I've been able to do with my podcast, because
I started, you know, talking to other people, but I've really honed in on a lot of researchers is what I'm trying to do to get their view on their research. Because so often, you know, you look at science writers today, I don't know what degrees they need because it's kind of sad what a lot of them tend to report. I don't know what they understand or not, but there's still a lot of miscommunication coming out about these people's research. And most of them want to be nuanced. Most of them are like, no, this isn't exactly what, you know, people are taking our findings and, you know, making them sensational. And they're not.
Oh, they the we love headlines, right?
Maybe it tells us this, and maybe the it goes
flash
like
in
that.
The pan. And I can't. Ugh. Biggest pet peeve is when you turn on the news and it's like new study and shows, and then they say like four words, and I'm like, there's no way that a study shows that like thing, and only that, and there's no nuance to it. Like, and now it's on the freaking national news. Like,
exactly.
Which is why I appreciate your work so much. You know, it's so important.
And I want to give researchers the chance themselves to talk about these issues, right? Is that they know better than all of us. What were their limitations? What were, because sometimes some of the limitations don't even make it into the paper. I can read it, but you know, I've spoken to people where they then talk about, oh yeah, and then this happened. And you're like, wow, that's fascinating. And that does speak to how we interpret the data. But it's important to have that as a record, and that gets lost in the attempt to sensationalize things. Mm-hmm. And so I do hope that, you know, as you said, that parents don't necessarily have the resources to understand the research, but if we can get it from the researchers themselves and hear what they want people to take from their research, well, I don't have to necessarily agree with it, but at least we're getting it, you know, from the proverbial horse's mouth.
Which I really, I love that about your podcast. And for me, like, I'm going to be very honest, like, I'm an early childhood educator. That's my background. I do not know how to read research. And so, and it's actually a pet peeve for me when I see, like, on Instagram or whatever, especially sleep trainers, but in general, when people are like, oh, here's a study that proves XYZ, and they link it. And it's like, you can't do that. You can't just put out a paper for parents to read, because most people don't know how to read it, right? And I mean,
and
yes, information
won't read
should be
it.
Available.
They're just going to read the headline that you said,
but
which
they
is
see,
the study proves, blah, blah, blah.
And they see, oh, they linked a study. They know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
And yes, information should be readily available for everybody, but not everybody knows how to read it. And I mean, we see this, I don't even want to get into it, but we see this in the conspiracy theory world, people who, you know, pick up medical research and they're like, oh, but see, it clearly says this. And I'm like, dude, you have no idea how to read that. Like, you're just, you can't just Google shit and then think you know what you're talking about. And so I think that's what happens in the parenting world. So I really love that you do that and you make it, you know, and you have these discussions with the researchers, because it helps people like me understand their research and the nuance and all of that. So I think it's so, so important. And by the way, anybody who works with kids, with infants and toddlers, and if you're a researcher, or sorry, if you're a, like a sleep coach or even breastfeeding specialist, you should definitely take Tracy's courses. They're actually quite affordable, but they're very specifically good for professionals, because you really go over all of the research, and it's really helpful. So thank you for that.
I really want to take your
the sleep training ones that are through breastfeeding conferences are certified. So if you are an IBCLC, you get continuing education credits for them.
Perfect.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
The goal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But definitely check out Tracy's course. You have an upcoming course on orchids, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Orchids and sleep. So definitely check that out, guys. But my question is, because I think this is also a debated topic in the gentle sleep world, and is, what are your thoughts on the crying in arms situation?
So that is a whole minefield, because
I know it is. It's a long
one. So there's a a short nuggety answer here. crying, there's two values to this. If generally speaking, crying in arms does assist our children's regulation. So when they are in arms and they're upset and we are comforting them, we are calming them. However, right. there's a potential nuance, and I have to say potential because it's not based on this, but there's a lot of neuroscientists talking about it, which is if we are the cause of our children's distress, and we do see right. this, there is some research backing this up. If we cause the distress, we are not as good as regulating them. So therefore, and this then leads to, okay, what's happening? So if my child falls and hurts themselves, I may not be able to get them to stop crying right away, but my comforting them will actually ease the burden of that stress. Mm-hmm. But if my child needs something from me and I'm not giving it to them, my ability to comfort them in arms may not be as great. And we see this in younger infancy. It's done in studies where the parents actually cause a bit of distress by withholding stuff from them or, you know, having
withholding to be the ones night breastfeeding sessions. I'll just hop right in and say this has got to be a really common trying to night wean from night nursing. Like, yes, you're holding them. This is like the exact scenario that you're talking about. But you are withholding the thing that is making them upset, right?
And so depending on the level of understanding, we don't know how, you know, does it offer some protection in terms of a stress response? Possibly. We haven't looked in those specific situations. But in the studies where the kids are younger, what we see is when parents are the source of distress, the ability to calm is less. In fact, right. even the ability to utilize basic what we would call self-soothing, but they're more reflective self-soothing. So kids, you know, that put their hands in their mouth or something like that. Mm-hmm. They consider that almost reflective because kids may do it without consciously trying to do it, but they do that. And those are all less. So it seems that our being a source of distress causes a higher level of distress for our kids, that what they have to regulate themselves becomes less. So are we competent in being able to comfort them? Probably to a certain degree. It's better than nothing, absolutely. I think every parent would kind of recognize that. But do we have the evidence that it's as effective? No. We don't know what that is. And the thought process from a lot of the researchers that I have read and looked at seem to feel that there would be a difference, and we would expect a difference based on what we know more generally.
Really interesting.
How strong it is and what's happening, again, we don't know. So that is, you know, so in terms of, you know, if you're trying to, I don't know, get your baby to sleep and they're screaming and you put them in arms, are you being as effective if you're the one that they, that, and yet again, it depends on the child's perception. Do they perceive you as being the cause of their distress? And with young kids, that's really hard to tell. We don't know if it's not explicit, right? The secondary issue to that is I often hear it used in terms of my baby cries almost every night to get to sleep and I just have to hold them, but they scream and cry. At some point, I just say, you are probably buffering in that moment if you're not the cause and we don't know what's going on. You know, you're trying, you've offered, you know, whether it's the breast or a bottle, you've comforting, you're rocking, nothing's working. Okay, you're holding them, you're offering comfort, probably very positive, because if you can't actively fix it, it's probably not coming from you. However, on a larger scale, if your kid's crying that much every night, it's probably worth looking at what else might be going on.
What's going on
to cause that distress? Is it new daycare that isn't working? Is there too much stimulation in the evening? Do you live somewhere, you know, loud noises, everything? What's happening that you need to be looking into?
I have a serious pet peeve. I remember when I took a newborn class, they talked about purple crying. And they just talked about, you know, it's normal if your baby like cries all day long at this age and you can't do anything. And I'm like, what? No, it's not. Like, I was still pregnant. I was like, no, it's not. It's not normal. Like, you know, and I know, like, I think a lot of this stuff is always about making parents feel better. And I get it. Like, obviously, no parent wants to feel like there's something wrong and whatever. But you know, it's okay if you're not a terrible parent if you can't figure out why your kid is crying. But at the same time, your kid is crying for a reason. They're not just crying because they're crying, right? So I think that, you know, there's so much, like, I think our society just gets the crying thing very confused. But I think the whole crying in arms thing, it's interesting to me because, for example, where I see this come up a lot is when it comes to involving a partner. And so I've had, you know, I had, for example, a parent I was working with, and they were like, the baby actually liked the dad the best. And so when mom was in there, the baby would cry, and they were like, well, we don't want to let her cry too long, because we heard that when babies are crying, the cortisol levels, and then this is again where the whole research gets convoluted, because they're like, the cortisol levels are rising and they're stressed out. And I'm like, well, it's not quite like that. Like, you are there. It's different. It's not the same as shutting the door and walking away. But again, at what point, you know, people will ask me this all the time. Well, how long do I let them cry with my partner before I go in? And I'm like, I don't have an answer for you, because it's a very nuanced discussion. I was just curious to know what your thoughts are on that piece.
Like, well, that specific case, there's actually a few pieces of the puzzle here that I think aren't well discussed in the parenting literature. But first off, when you have a parent who's not the favorite, so if we look at non-human primate research, unfortunately, what it shows us is that when infants are separated, and so again, depends on the age, separated from the caregiver that they view as their attachment figure in non-human primate research, it's the mothers. Even when they're with, and this has been the interesting part, even when they're with their alloparents, so grandparents, aunts, who they have been raised with, it does not lower their stress. So if they are wanting to be with mom, that is not actually offering a buffer to their stress. That said, there was one early study from Megan Gunner and colleagues that looked at the stress response of a baby with a responsive caregiver who was responding to their cries through separation, and that did buffer for 30 minutes. So we don't know, again, this. Mm-hmm. Then we add the temperament into the mix. If you have a highly sensitive, or what term ORCID through Thomas Boyce's work, child who is more stress reactive, they do not regulate as well. So we see that actually they are the ones that are far more likely to have very high stress levels and far faster and not be regulated by others. So that comes into play as a third piece there. But then the other piece to this is how long, what does it look like? I think some of the struggle with other partners, and I do a lot of work with this with families, is going back to Kylie Hanlon's work on hinderers and helpers. And young babies are actually really good at telling if someone is helping another or hindering another. And they do it at a very young age. It's a fascinating, like, they are months old. My daughter was part of these studies, and it was fascinating to watch. So when they think someone is actually blocking someone from achieving their goal, they do not like that person at all. They are very clear. Sometimes as they get older, you know, if it's a puppet, there's throwing the puppet away, there's hitting it, there's that. They are very no. But they like the helpers who seem to be helping people. Whether they succeed at helping or not, they like the helpers. So with parents, you know, it's how long do you hold your child for? Well, I, from a psychological perspective, think, and again, this is my assumption, and the way it's worked out with families, it seems to be at play. Families where you have one partner who's holding the baby, it seems to me that it's very logical for the baby to see it as, you're preventing me from getting to mom. You are a hinderer. As a hinderer, can you help with that? Probably not very well, because you're seen as blocking something that the baby normally has. So what I often advocate is, if you are in this situation where your baby is not being comforted by one parent, you have to become the helper. And just think of it, babies are incredibly good at picking up on nonverbal cues. This is what we see time and again in the research. They're very good. So you take the situation where I'm with the caregiver who's holding me, I don't trust, you're not the one I want. And then suddenly mom comes into the room, arms out, takes me back in. What's happened is a nonverbal situation of, if you watched it on mute, it could be kind of a, oh, mom came and saved the day. She rescued me from this person who was keeping me from you. And that's very likely the interpretation that babies have of what's going on. So instead, even subtle things of, if you want to switch over to another caregiver starting to comfort, pick them up, acknowledge, oh, I think you really want mom. Let me help you. I'm going to take you. And then hand baby over to mom. And over time, through repetition, that person becomes, they're the ones who are facilitating the child to get to the person they want. And once that happens enough, you then yourself are trustworthy, because, oh, now I can calm with you. because you're actually here to help me. You're not here to hinder me. So I, because mm-hmm. I've seen families down the line of trying that holding for extended periods where kids now scream at even getting close to the other parent. And that is devastating for another parent, right? That is mm-hmm. not beneficial. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think some of the reason we don't see this, you look at cross-cultural research in a lot of hunter-gatherer societies where kids don't have a separation anxiety and they tend to be comfortable with everyone. Well, starting very young, they are spending 40% of their time away from mom, but not in one big chunk. They go off to some person for 10, 20 minutes. They cry, they get brought back to mom. Go to someone else, brought back. And crucial to that is they're being brought back to mom. Mom's not chasing mm-hmm. after them everywhere they are, right? Mom's doing what she's doing and people just keep bringing baby back to her. So you think about that exposure wow. multiple times a day, every day for months on end, you are learning that everyone else around you is your helper and they will facilitate uh-huh. your emotional needs. And at a young age, that emotional need is to that primary
so much to. It's so interesting because I hear this yeah, so much goal. In our culture now, which is the opposite, where the mom has to be constantly like, give me my baby back.
Yeah.
Because people not, are like, oh, I got them. Yeah. I remember this drove me nuts when my baby was small. I was like, give me my baby. Like,
you know, not, but, you don't got this.
yeah, you I don't got this. They're asking for me. But yeah, yeah, like, oh my God, I wish like everybody knew that because that's so crucial.
I'm even thinking about, we're kind of dealing with Paul. I was just kind of lamenting to Paula. My daughter is two. She's barely two. She's just started this, mommy, do it, mommy, do it, mommy, do it. When my husband tries to like get her dressed in the morning, it just happened this morning, full meltdown. I'm trying to get out of the shower. I'm half naked. And I'm like, oh my gosh, run in there. And like you said, I took over. Dad leaves the room. I yep. saved the day, but we didn't used to have that pattern. We really used to have a pattern of when she was a baby, she would wake. My husband would kind of like comfort her as I got ready to nurse her and he would bring her to me. Yes. I was never going to them and taking her from him. He would bring her to me. But now that she's a toddler and she's two, it's like, well, I can't physically get you dressed right now because I'm trying to like get out of the shower and dad mm-hmm. needs to get you dressed. And then it just becomes this like, you know, it's just really interesting, like just kind of way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
And that's also,
the switch of having dad say, okay, well, let's go talk to mom about it coming mm-hmm. out of the shower. And then I'm getting changed. You think dad could do it? Maybe he would, but maybe yeah. she would, pardon me, accept that.
Yeah.
And if not, then it's like, okay, well, we're just going to wait for me to get ready. And, you know, sometimes we do have to wait a bit and be like, mm-hmm. you know, how about you and dad pick the clothes and then I'll be in when I'm ready mm-hmm. to get you dressed. And we do accept that, yeah, we're in a rush, but those extra 3 minutes aren't probably going to make or break the day.
Thank you so much, Tracy. It was a great conversation. I'm sure people got a lot out of it. I definitely did.
Every time I hear you, mm-hmm. where can people find you? What do you...
So I have obviously the site, evolutionaryparenting.com. On Facebook, I have two kind of pages, which is Evolutionary Parenting and then Tracy Castles, PhD. And then on Instagram, which I am at now, I know the banging on the door there. I've got a little one who is very done with me being in here.
That's so funny.
Which is at Tracy Castles, PhD, I think is what mm-hmm. it is. But yeah, mm-hmm. those are really the main spaces for me.
We'll put amazing. All that in
we'll drop show. Those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank you so much. I mean, everything you say is so helpful. So thank you so much.
You're doing
here.
Amazing work with your research background and like what you can do with that. It's very awesome. So thanks.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Way We Parent podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review on iTunes to help others find us. Share it with your friends and tag us on Instagram at the Way We Parent podcast. Let us know who you want to have on next or what topics you want us to cover. See you next time.